Land of America and the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going live to the United Kingdom. Jonathan Downs, Richard Freeman. We're going to investigate chupacabras. By the way, on the Coast to Coast AM website, under feature article, look at the picture that Lex has posted. It is stunning. Enlarge it. Tell me by fast blast what you think that object is chasing a deer. Let me tell you something. If they faked it, if it's a hoax, it's a darn good one. Take a look at that. The picture of what could be a chupacabra. Here's some quick stories of the day. Audio tapes purported to be from Osama bin Laden's top lieutenant aired on Arabic TV stations, one taunting President Bush and threatening more attacks on the United States. The second criticizing France's decision to ban Islamic headscarves in schools. Portions of the separate audio tapes were attributed to Amin al-Zawahiri, and they were broadcast a few hours apart on the two Arabic TV stations, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, competing pan-Arab satellite channels based, of course, in the Persian Gulf. Officials at both stations said that they had aired only excerpts judged newsworthy. The station said that they had received different tapes. In the Al Jazeera tape, the voice believed to be al-Jawahiri challenged Bush's claim to have liberated Iraq and indicated al-Qaeda is still running operations from Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, there have been some reports that Osama bin Laden is trying to sneak his way back into Afghanistan. CIA Director George Tenet has rejected charges that U.S. intelligence officials missed an opportunity to uncover a terror cell in Germany that apparently was a key element in the 9/11 terror attacks. German officials reportedly gave the first name and phone number of one of the hijackers who succeeded in destroying the World Trade Center more than 2 years before the attacks on America. But Tenet said that his agency did not get the last name of the terrorist until after the terror attack. In Morocco, as our two guests last night had reported, David Booth and Wayne Green, there was indeed an earthquake in Morocco. The latest report, more than 560 people have died in these powerful earthquakes. A big one of 6.1 to 6.3 on the Richter scale, and then a smaller one after that. 560 people, as they slept, died in that earthquake. Now, here's a story that is pretty darn frightening, especially on the heels of last night's program. Astronomers have revealed how they came within minutes of alerting the world to a potential asteroid strike last month. Some of us say, hey, that can't happen, right? No. Some scientists believe that on January 13th, a 90-foot object, later designated as 2004 AS1, had a 1 in 4 chance of hitting the planet within 36 hours. That's the kind of notice we would have been given. It could have caused local devastation, and the researchers contemplated a call to President Bush before new data finally showed that there was no danger, not to worry. The procedures for raising the alarm in such circumstances are now being revised. These astronomers say that there would have been an impact somewhere in the northern hemisphere, exactly where they do not know, again, had it had that 1 in 4 chance. Also, the asteroid believed to have wiped out dinosaurs 65 million years ago was rare, they say, but hardly unique. Scientists gather to discuss ways of aggressively defending our planet from another such space rock. They're talking about different ways that they might be able to divert an asteroid that's coming our way. They've proposed strategies to nudge an asteroid off course. That includes using lasers, mirrors, or atomic weapons launched from Earth. What I find interesting about both of these stories is that they all revolve around the possibility of an asteroid hitting the planet. Again, last night on Coast to Coast, Wayne Green and David Booth. David Booth, of course, in 1979, had a vision of a plane crash in Chicago. He alerted the FAA. They have documented it. The plane crash did occur. He had 10 recurring vision dreams when that happened. Not until then, that's 1979. In 2003, David Booth had 10 more recurring dream visions, but this time of an object of what he called planetary size hitting the planet in the South Pole sometime this year. This year. It's a frightening program, frightening because of his accuracy from his 1979 vision. That's the most important thing. While we were talking with David Booth last night, he mentioned James McCanney and James's thoughts and views on comets. So in a moment this hour, our guest will be physicist James McCanney on Coast to Coast AM. Professor James McCanney, he's got a Master of Science degree as a physicist. He spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and proved that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. He has openly opposed NASA's view that outer space is electrically neutral. McCanney was a faculty member of the Physics and Mathematics Department of Cornell University. That's in Ithaca, New York. He has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics. And for a lot of people who might not know that, these are studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space. And has also presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and American Geophysical Union. We turn to Professor McCanney when we have had stories on sunspots, solar flares, and now possibilities of comets coming very close to planet Earth again. And last night, of course, Professor, our guest David Booth specifically talked about the work that you have done. And he believes, honestly believes in his visions that something's going to happen to our planet this year. And I thought it might be a good time to bring you in light of the fact that sometime in April and May, there could be some electrical spikes as well. So how are you, James? Good to have you with us.
George, thank you for inviting me back. And yes, we could have some celestial fireworks here. These two not being directly Earth-affecting, but the whole entourage that these represent certainly brings the possibility that we're moving very close to something big in the solar system. And then I've been watching, of course, we've talked about this on past shows, the comets from the south, in the videos that I have showing these comets. So absolutely, we're in a time when the solar system is becoming very active. I listened with interest on the 2004 AS1 asteroid. I proposed a method for moving asteroids also using the tail drag method that my comet theory predicts and has now been proven. But
now, what is that?
Well, what would happen is these asteroids are in the electric field of the sun, just like comets and the planets, and if you extended out a long tether from that object, you would induce the breakdown of that capacitor, causing tail material to come in just like a comet to the asteroid, and it's a natural process to alter the orbit of something. And we see this, for example, with Hale-Bopp, which had its orbit altered tremendously because of the tail drag. So it's a natural process. It's not like giving it a pill or a bomb or something. You could actually use a natural process by simply allowing a tether to stream out behind it in its orbit. So at any rate, I just wanted to mention that.
Okay. Well, Professor, tell us a little bit about these comets and what we can expect from around April 25th to May 3rd.
Let's abbreviate the comets' names to make it a little easier for people to follow. One is full name is called C2001Q4, so it was discovered in 2001 by the NEAT program. And that comet came right down the plane of the planets, a little bit underneath, is passing up through the plane of the planets on May 15th, and then will go up and back out parallel to the direction it came in. So let's call that one Q4.
Okay.
And then the other comet is C2002. It was discovered in 2002,
mm-hmm.
T7, by the LINEAR program. And that comet has a little bit stranger orbit. It's coming in from the south, wrapping around the sun, and then it heads south through the ecliptic, or the plane of the planets, on about, I think it's also in May. But I'm not going to concentrate on those orbital parameters as much as certain dates when very certain alignments are going to occur. For example, on May 11th, Q4 will have a perfect electrical alignment with the planet Venus.
And so what does that mean to
well,
us?
Well, what happens is all of the planets themselves have electrical alignments with the sun. And, for example, when Mercury, Venus, say our moon, come into alignment with the sun, they cause weather effects and other types of effects because these long electrical currents lash together, so to speak. And so in this case, we could see from the 11th to the 15th, when this comet comes up and crosses the ecliptic, and we're going to have a very beautiful broadside view of this comet from the northern hemisphere, from the 11th to the 15th, and we'll be able to possibly see what I call a sunward spike, something astronomers have seen many times but always seem to find an excuse for what they're seeing. We may have a chance to talk a little bit about that.
Well, so what can a spike do, though, James?
Well, a spike for these comets will simply be visual, but what it will do is prove that the sunward spike is real, and
okay.
the populace
okay.
will be able to hopefully see this. And comets are very difficult to predict, so it's you always have reservations when you make predictions about comets, because some of them fizzle, some of them just the sun conditions aren't correct at the time. So, but if the enough of these come through, the public eventually is going to see the sunward spike. So that's Q4. Now, T7 has quite a bit more activity on May 6th in the morning sky. Now, see, nobody's talking about this comet in the morning sky. It's going to be very visible, and it's going to have a perfect electrical alignment with the planet Mercury on May 6th.
Now, is this unusual to have two comets zooming by? Now, I know, I think 1998, two comets almost simultaneously smashed into the sun. The sun is so immense, it really didn't do too much. But how unusual is this?
Well, to have two comets on totally different orbits that come close to Earth, these are both within one-third of an astronomical unit of Earth at closest approach, which means even if they're smaller comets, they'll still be relatively visible. So that's somewhat unusual. People should understand that at any given moment, for people who observe comets, there's probably a dozen comets wandering around the solar system that you could view with a telescope, a modest telescope, at any given time. So comets are around us all the time, but the fact that these two happen to be coming into view and will be naked eye visible, probably, that's very unusual. And when May 19th, T7 will pass from a morning object to an evening object, and at that point we'll have both comets in the western sky, although at that point T7 will be only visible in the southern hemisphere. So for most of our listening audience here, that'll be a non-event unless they decide to travel to the southern hemisphere.
All right, now last night on the program, David Booth, was talking about what will be the beginning of our timetable for what he believes to be a real catastrophe that will occur on this planet, coming up from the South Pole, getting hit by a very large, almost planetary-sized object. Now, to me, we should be seeing this by now. He claims that we are. He claims that there are a number of astronomers down there in the South Pole and scientists now doing some work. Are you privy, James, to any of that information, or have you heard anything about scientists being down at Antarctica spotting one or two major objects that might be coming this way?
Well, yes. Definitely there's a large number of astronomers and increasingly large facilities that are being placed in Antarctica at the South Pole. And interestingly enough, there's nothing at the North Pole. So there's very definitely something going on. Myself last year made an attempt to go to the Southern Hemisphere to view, and I learned the hard way that the only good viewing conditions to look directly off the southern part of the Earth, the only good location is Antarctica. Because of the haze layer that has developed around Earth. Now, when you're looking for something such as a diffuse cloud of water around a comet, then the only place you can really get a good view of this from this location we think this object is coming from, directly off the South Pole of the Earth. In other words, if you were standing at the South Pole, it would be straight above your head.
All right, now Can amateur astronomers, for example, see this object if they're in the northern hemisphere? Probably not, I would
say. No. Right. And even if you are in the southern hemisphere, and this is what I ran into, you have a haze layer of water at about 30,000 feet, and there's no high mountains in the southern hemisphere. Patagonia, which is at the tip of South America, and then New Zealand, being the southernmost land areas, are surrounded by water. And even the southern tip of Africa is only 30 degrees south. So when you're looking at an angle through the atmosphere, say 20, 30, 40 degrees off the horizon, you're literally blocked from seeing anything dealing with water in it, mainly a comet. So you're not going to see a bright speck because that nucleus is being blocked by the coma of the comet. So only from the South Pole can you see diffuse comets, especially ones that are far out in the solar system. Eventually, one would imagine we would start seeing this, but there again, we just really don't have a lot of observational power down in that southern region.
Do you believe there's an object coming this way?
Oh, yes, and I have for a long time. My estimation is, first of all, there's a massive, large object that's probably still quite far out in the solar system, and that's the thing that Harrington was able to detect back as early as 1992 and observe. But at that point, the object was well outside of our solar system, the solar capacitor, and you could actually see the object as soon as it broke into that very distant region where there is a solar capacitor and material to start gathering around this object, then all of a sudden it becomes clouded and in a haze, so to speak, and it becomes almost impossible, except with good infrared equipment, to see the object itself.
James, I would or could interview 20 astronomers, and I guarantee you 20 of them would say there is no object coming this way. So are they lying to me? Do they not know? Or are they, what's going on here?
Well, I finally defined what I call the tier level of science and scientists, and there's a very, the top tier of scientists, what I call the tier one scientists, have access to equipment, have access to the ability to see these things, and it's literally a national security issue. And the second tier of scientists, these would be the ones that we normally consider the top scientists. These would work at Goddard or JPL.
Right.
Really do not have access to this information, and they let these people think they do because they're the ones that have to interface with the public. And so when they're saying they don't believe there's anything, they're not lying, they're not hiding anything. They simply don't have access to the top level of information, but they think they do.
David Booth mentioned something about a Venus factor in June. I want to ask you about that when we come right back, and also get your take then on his vision. And his vision was something is going to happen around September of 2004. Now, there is an asteroid that's coming within a million miles of the planet on the 29th of September. I don't think that's it, because he said in his vision, if he's correct, it was a planetary-sized object, which could very well be a comet-sized object. We'll be back with you in a moment. Professor James McCanney, my guest this hour. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Reserve your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin when you subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. On the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And at the top of the hour, in a few moments, two guests as we go live to the United Kingdom, Jonathan Downs and, of course, Richard Freeman. We are going to be talking about what they believe to be the terrifying chupacabra. And on the coasttocoastam.com website, under the featured article, very interesting picture. Lex doing some massive research right now, and we'll post another rebuttal type picture up there, because we continue to work on Coast to Coast to bring you the truth and to solve the mysteries. The March issue of the After Dark newsletter includes many fascinating topics, one of which is tsunamis and the possibility that if a volcano at the Canary Islands goes, what could happen to the eastern seaboard of the United States? It's in the March issue of the After Dark newsletter. Couple ways to order. One is toll-free, 1-888-727-5505. The other way, of course, is coasttocoastam.com. We have had such a phenomenal response to the CD, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin, this limited edition, the one that will end eventually. We're going to extend it for just a short while longer, so you can take advantage of this. It's a free CD, and again, it's on exorcisms with Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 1-888-727-5505, and you can order it online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Professor James McCanney this hour. James, what is this Venus factor that could occur sometime around June? Can you explain that for us at all?
Well, Venus has every 500 and so many days a inferior conjunction with Earth. This time it's going to be a near perfect alignment between Earth and the Sun. And we know from data that the sunspot count, for example, has a little bump every time there's a Venus inferior conjunction. So, you know, if depending on the solar conditions, the electrical conditions in the solar system, we could have an effect more or less on Earth, including weather effects. So June 8th, according to my weather theoretical work, would be a date when you would say there's a possibility of some early Atlantic hurricane action. So at any rate, there are other factors. Right now, the sun has quiesced. It's very calm right now, although we're looking at some sunspots that could develop. And it really depends a lot on the sun and the solar system conditions at the time. So right now, it's hard to predict exactly what could happen. June 8th is the actual transit date. Like I said before, I believe May 12th is when Q4 aligns with Venus. Mm. And we don't know at this point, I don't know specifically what effects could occur. Those are just, you would say those are pointers or indicators that something could happen, something to watch for. But I'm not aware of anything other than that that's related to Venus, nothing in the solar system at this time that would tell me, you know, something bigger than an average transit or inferior conjunction would occur.
You don't seem to be saying the sky is falling. You don't seem to be very concerned about the possibility of devastation. Is that because you're cool, calm, and collected, or do you not believe that something could happen?
Well, I've been working on these type of issues for 3 decades now. I've seen a lot of things come and go, and the alignment I see with Venus is not earth-shattering, but you couple that with conditions that could occur between now and then,
yes,
things could get pretty earth-shattering. So you don't know, but, and yeah, I tend to be have my keel straight down in the water, so to speak, and, you know, calm and collected, so to speak. And as far as other things, I don't make predictions unless I have scientific data with which to make them. I made, for example, last summer, I made the prediction of the August 27th extreme worldwide weather situation, and that kicked off perfectly on cue on the 27th.
All right, but do you believe that David Booth, who I believe has good intentions, and he believes that something could happen object-wise around September of this year, do you believe that he could be off by a number of years?
I don't know, and I guess the time will tell on predictions. I myself do not make predictions, as you know, and so I don't tie my hat to anything that I can't see in terms of data, and there's a lot of things I cannot see right now. For example, when we've seen comets coming in from the south, these things are moving extremely, extremely fast. They're covering the distance from Pluto into the sun in a matter of a very short time. So these things are really moving.
Now, what's your definition of a short time? Let's say from Mars to the sun, how long would that take?
I believe some of them would make that in a matter of about a week.
That's pretty fast.
They're really moving. So there's kind of a misconception that everything moves slowly and reacts slowly like the planets do. But there's stuff out in outer space moving along at incredible speeds. That's why it's so dangerous to be hit by one of these asteroids. They're moving, even though it might be small. If it hits you at 30 miles an hour, wouldn't be a big deal. But they're coming at 100,000 miles an hour.
Exactly. And if they hit you at at a proper angle, we're in a lot of trouble.
Right.
How big is the surface of a comet, albeit metallic or water ice, for example? But how big are they?
Well, they range from very little to planet-sized. And this is another one of the misnomers that comes out of standard astronomy, that these things are all half a mile wide, little ice balls. And that's simply not true. And I think the public became aware of this when they saw Comet Neat V1 come by last February. And you could see it next to the sun with the naked eye right at sundown. This is a very huge nucleus, and clearly not something a half a mile wide. I've given an example. I finally figured out that people need an example of what solar conditions are like where Comet Neat passed by. Take a fire hose. The water would be coming out the fire hose at around 600,000 miles per second, or 600 miles per second, and or kilometers per second. It would be about 6,000 degrees, and you're telling me that there's a half a mile wide rock with a little sprinkling of snow on it that is making that huge comet? It wouldn't last a second there. You can only have something extremely durable, like rock or steel or iron, let's say, to withstand that kind of torture. So the one issue is the extreme conditions we see near the sun when comets pass very near the sun, and they come out the other side relatively unaffected. We've even seen comets that are sun grazers go right into the solar atmosphere and come out the other side.
All right, well, but based on what we know right now, James, based on what you know as a physicist, and you are somewhat of a rebel because not every physicist agrees with you.
Correct.
In your opinion, what do we know right now about the possibility of the planet getting hit, if something happening nearby, if a major league disruption because of solar flares, about the possibility of a pole flip? What do we know?
Well, the situation is as follows. I talk about action at a distance. It's one of the main themes in my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, and my other books, that we don't have to be hit by something. And this recurring theme that comes out of standard science that we have to be hit is garbage. The Earth is littered with artifacts, mountain ranges, and all kinds of other geological conditions that could not possibly have formed by the planet itself or by the impact of an asteroid. These are only caused by the passage of a very large celestial object that sets up a gravitational wave in the planet. We also have a lot of evidence of electrical discharges that have occurred between comets and planets. And these earmark the solar system also. So action at a distance is the key. Right now we're seeing a sun that is totally out of line with anything it should be, and astronomers are finally, and the Meteorological Association is finally saying there's something wrong here. But they downplay it. The situation, however, is that the sun is reacting to something in our solar system. I believe it's coming in from the south, and that interaction pumps up the sun and the sun's energy, mm-hmm. and we see that in the form of solar flaring.
Do you see this as a single object here?
No, it's an entourage. There's one central large object, and it has an entire entourage of smaller objects.
Smaller ones behind it?
Yeah, but some of those may be planetary size.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, to me, that's not small, James.
No, well, compared to the big one, it's small. So my view is we literally have another solar system moving into our solar system, and that's why I kept talking about the comets from the south. And people have to shed this idea that comets are dirty snowballs. A comet is literally an electrical interaction in the solar system of some object. It doesn't have to be, it can be a light rock, it can be mm-hmm. a dense rock, it could be solid iron.
See, and David Booth last night in his vision saw only one planetary size object, and he mentioned that several times because I asked him if you'd have other ones behind it. He said, I don't know. All I know is my vision was one planetary size object. So I'm not questioning you or him, but in his vision, that's all he saw.
Yeah, and in historical records, we know that the ancients saw like multiple comets at one time in the solar system, big ones, the kind that we have not seen in modern scientific times. And I think too many times astronomers extrapolate what we've seen in the last 300 years as being the only thing there could be, and that's simply we don't have enough experience astronomically in the sense of seeing things with equipment, telescopes, that would be extrapolated to thousands or even millions of years. So there might be gigando things floating around out there that have come by the solar system, affected things, and we don't have any record of. So the bottom line is the record we do see, however, is in the geological record, showing that Earth, in fact, many, many dozens of times has been affected by close passage of a large object. So that's why we look for our record. We also look to the historical record. I pulled out a little passage, just if I got a second to read
it. Yes, you do. Go ahead.
From the Colbran, which I use quite a bit to refer back to those historic days. This refers to a comet. Says, then came the day when all things became still and apprehensive, for God caused a sign to appear in the heavens so that men should know that the earth would be afflicted, and the sign was a strange star. The star grew and waxed to a great brightness and was awesome to behold. It put forth horns and sang. And then down below it says, he carried lightnings in his hand. And this is why I want people to view these comets. In fact, I've drawn up a viewing chart, which I'm offering. We can talk about that right at the end of the hour here. But these ancient people saw these horns and sunward protrusions out of these comets. And so these are big. They're many of them are small. The ones like Halley's Comet, we passed through its tail in 1910, not a big deal. But that's a teeny, teeny little comet, and it's not comparable to something like Hale-Bopp was a kind of a medium-sized comet. And the nucleus, that's a good example. The nucleus of Hale-Bopp is quoted as being about 40 kilometers. It was more like half the size of our moon.
Do you believe that world governments are holding back information from telling us?
Absolutely, and I have firsthand direct knowledge of that. Absolutely. And here again, this is what I call the tier one science. It goes up the ladder. It goes up to the world, the people basically operating the world, and it's not passed down to the public. We get the dribble and the second tier of science where they think they're right and they have no clue about what's really going on above them. And one of the biggest issues here is the issue of celestial interaction with Earth. I think a lot of the political situations in the world right now are direct results of them expecting something coming in.
Well, in an indirect way, you kind of back up what the guests, David Booth and Wayne Green, had to say last night.
Well, absolutely. And the only difference is I don't put a date on it, and
that's right.
I don't have a way of seeing like possibly David does. I don't confirm or deny it. It's simply, but one thing I will say is I think we're heading into an era when people are going to start seeing these signs in the heavens, and they're going to drop what they're doing and they're going to stand there and look at it. And that's what the governments of the world do not want. So let's get that out in the open.
Well, I kind of had hoped that he wasn't so darn accurate with his first vision, because, as I said last night on the program, that adds to his credibility in this vision.
Mm-hmm.
And, if he was so accurate the first time, and he has not had one until he had the second one in March of 2003, well, lo and behold.
I talk with David. I'm the, talk with David and Wayne and... We chat about a lot of things, so I'm, and all kinds of other things like earthquakes. Like today I was talking with David about the earthquakes near the South Pole, which aren't supposed to happen.
Well, and Morocco had a huge one last night.
Yeah, yeah. And we've, the list today of earthquakes, there's probably 35 earthquakes today, many of them large, many, about half of them in Alaska. A good number around the Yellowstone region and a bunch down in Mexico.
Well, I know, and if Yellowstone goes, we're also in trouble. James, your website, would you spell that out for us?
Is www.jmcanniescience.com. That's JMCCANNEY. And just for the show tonight, I usually do some kind of a special. I'm offering the Planet X book, $15. That's quite a few dollars off the purchase price. But the 15 would include postage, or 2 for $25, and I'm going to include a viewing chart of these comets in each book, so people will know what to look for, and also specifics of how to view the cometary spike. And people can also get this by mail at JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392.
And that address is also on your website?
Yes, it's actually down in the website, mail order information.
Well,
at the top of my page I have that, but we'll talk again about this.
I'm afraid this is not going to go away, James, is it?
I'm sure we're already scheduling another visit here on this somewhere in the future.
Oh my. As I told David Booth last night as well, I said, David, I hope you're wrong, but he doesn't think he is, James.
Well, we shall see. And these comets, people will want to find out exactly how to view them to get a bird's eye view for themselves.
All right, very good. Thanks, James. Physicist Professor James McCanny updating us on some situations in space. We bring it to you. When we come right back, we're going chupacabra hunting on Coast to Coast AM.
Would you pay 15 cents to hear this show in its entirety? That's the daily charge for Streamlink. Sign up at www.coasttocoastam.com. And some people. Coast to Coast AM with George Norton.
Tonight, we'll explore the terrifying chupacabra, a vampire-like creature that exists perhaps somewhere between folklore and reality. We'll have two guests tonight. First hour, our guest will be Jonathan Downs. Our second hour, our guest will be Richard Freeman. In the third hour, both Jonathan and Richard will be back with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan Downs spent much of his childhood in Hong Kong, surrounded by age-old Chinese superstitions and a dazzling diverse range of exotic wildlife. He soon became infected with twin passions for exotic zoology and the paranormal. Together, he began writing professionally in the late 80s and has written 17 books so far. In 1992, he founded the Center for Fortean Zoology with the aim of coordinating research into mystery animals, bizarre, strange animal behavior, and his own particular love of zoo form, phenomena, paranormal entities, by the way, which only appear to be animals. He has searched for lake monsters at Loch Ness, pursued sea serpents and birdmen in Cornwall, chased big cats across West Country moorland, and in 1998 went to Latin America in search of the grotesque vampire-type chupacabra. I had the opportunity of meeting Jonathan Downs in Las Vegas several months ago at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference with Linda Moulton Howe, and a delightful person. Jonathan, welcome back to Coast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's my pleasure. Next hour, I'll have the pleasure of talking with Richard Freeman as well, and then the third hour, we'll have you both on, and we'll take phone calls. With both of you, likewise as well. Tell me a little bit about some of your searches, because you have had a life that a lot of people who love the paranormal, who love to investigate, would only dream about. How'd that all happen for you?
Well, it all happened basically because 15 years ago, I left my last proper job, and I decided that I'd spent the first half of my life doing what other people wanted me to do, and I was going to spend the rest of my life doing what I wanted to do. I was working, my ex-wife and I had a small publishing company, and we'd pretty well run out of money. And I decided I was going to spend the last few hundred pounds which I had in my bank account starting a little magazine about my passion for mystery animals. And we started one, and much to my surprise, instead of it just being a flash in the pan that no one would pay attention to, mm-hmm. it became a success. And mm-hmm. so I was able to do this full-time for a living. And now I travel around the world investigating mystery animals, writing books about them. And it's my honor to be I'm now the director of the world's biggest cryptozoological research organization.
Good for you. This planet, of course, Jonathan, being so immense, you know, sometimes all you have to do is take a plane flight from one coast to the next just here in the United States, and you realize this is a very big planet that is easily accessible with the right technology, but it's huge, absolutely huge. There are so many places on this planet that animals that we probably aren't even aware of might be hidden away, maybe living now. Do you think we'll ever find them all?
Probably not. Because for one thing is that evolution carries on all the time. And as we're speaking, new animals are evolving. So the idea that the animals that we're looking for are all things that have existed since prehistory and we haven't found them yet isn't actually true. There are new animals turning up all the time. New animals are evolving all the time. And new animals are being discovered all the time. And in the last few weeks, we've had two new species of snake discovered, several new species of fish discovered, all sorts of things. I get new discoveries coming in either by telephone, by fax, or my email inbox every day.
Will we ever get to the point when we find perhaps an actual live prehistoric dinosaur?
Not a dinosaur. I mean, you see dinosaurs every day. Because it's actually a fallacy that dinosaurs became extinct at the end of the Cretaceous. Because one type of dinosaurs are still very, very much with us every day, because birds are dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
One group of dinosaurs actually evolved into birds, and they're more successful now than they ever were. But in the sense of the word that you're asking now, I don't think that I think it's highly unlikely that there are any true big dinosaurs left to be discovered, but there are a heck of a lot of other large, very primitive, and very little known creatures from the same time as the dinosaurs.
Except maybe Nessie, right? That's a possibility.
Oh gosh, Loch Ness Monster exists, but I don't believe it's a dinosaur.
Oh, you
in
don't?
In the same way as in Africa, there are reports of a creature called Mecalium Bembe from the swamps of the Congo, and I believe that exists. I believe it's a type of enormous giant lizard which hasn't been discovered by mankind yet. It's not actually a dinosaur, but it's from the same time as the dinosaurs, and it's just as exciting.
Okay, and though I want to talk with you about chupacabras tonight.
Yeah, of course.
What do you think Nessie might be then?
My personal thought is that Nessie is a giant eel. But when I say giant, I mean very giant, 25 to 30 feet long. Because the interesting thing about eels, and I've got a new theory about this, which if anybody actually looks onto our website, you can actually see a piece of footage which was taken last year of a what appears to be a very large animal in Loch Ness. My theory is that they are giant eels, but I've got a good theory to explain why they're there. Because it's well known that both the North American eel and the European eel, they live part of their life in fresh water, but then when they become fully grown, they swim down to the Sargasso Sea in the South Atlantic to breed. Right. They spawn, they die, and then the babies swim back up the Atlantic again, and then swim back up the same rivers that their parents came from. But once in a while, an eel becomes sterile and no longer has the sexual imperative to make it swim down to the sea. And this is actually well known, that occasionally you get something called eunuch eels, which are sterile eels, and they grow very, very big. My theory is that in Loch Ness and in some of the other northern lakes where you have reports of lake monsters, there's something in the water which makes a larger than average percentage of the population of these eels to actually become sterile and grow to an enormous size, which would explain why you can only have, why there's at any one time only one or two of them in the lake. And it gets rid of the problem that people have had for years, that in order to support a viable breeding population, you need between 14 and 30 specimens of an animal, and that Loch Ness just is not big enough to, there just isn't enough food in there to be able to support a viable breeding population of these things. But there is enough food to support, say, one or two at a time of these ones that have by accident become sterile and become enormously large.
I always had this fascination, Jonathan, that Nessie might have been a plesiosaur.
It's a lovely idea, but there are several reasons why it couldn't have been a plesiosaur. One is that during the Ice Age, the lake was frozen solid, and anything that was there before the Ice Age just wouldn't have survived. The second thing is that plesiosaurs were air breathers, and there were just not enough sightings of a viable population of large air-breathing animals to live in the lake. They'd be seen far more often. And the third thing is the plesiosaurs bred, they gave birth to their young on land. And although there are sightings of Nessie on land, there were very few of them, and not enough, not as many as there would be if there had been a viable population of something like a plesiosaur there. And also, the plesiosaurs, being air breathers, would have shown up on the sonar scans, which show, they wouldn't show the animal, but they would show the reflection of the air in its lungs. And that, again, if it's a giant fish, it would explain why the sonar scans don't show up air in an animal's lungs, because fish don't have lungs.
Now, in 1992, you founded the Center for Forkian Zoology. Tell me a little bit about that organization.
Well, we're now the biggest and the fastest growing mystery animal research group in the world. You can actually, if you go to our website, which is www.cfz.org.uk, you can see reports of all the expeditions we've done, because now between us we've done I've done expeditions to Puerto Rico, to Mexico, various parts of the United States, as well as working all over Britain and Europe. My colleague Richard, who's on the show later, has done expeditions to Sumatra, looking for a primitive species of ape man, and he's done expeditions to Thailand, looking for giant snakes. And we've got another expedition to Sumatra penciled in for May this year, and we're going to be, all things being equal, we'll be back in the States looking for Bigfoot in June.
Gosh, there's so much to talk with you about tonight, Jonathan. I'm enjoying this. The hunt for the chupacabra. First of all, what does the word chupacabra mean?
Chupacabra literally in Spanish means the goat sucker. And the name was coined by peasants living in the Dorado sector of Puerto Rico in the mid-1990s. Now, it's a fallacy that the chupacabra only appeared in the mid-1990s, because I believe, and I've shown this in my book on the subject, I've shown that it's actually part of a continuum of ongoing Latin American vampire accounts which go back hundreds of years. It's just that the name itself was coined in the mid-1990s. It caught the global media attention in the mid-1990s and became famous then, but it's actually been going on for centuries.
Now, you said Puerto Rico. Are there other regions of this planet where we've had reports of chupacabra?
Well, yes. The chupacabra is actually really just the Latin American version of a global vampire mythos. But the chupacabra report started, came to the fore in Puerto Rico in the mid-1990s, and within a few years, there were reports from Mexico and then from Brazil. And now we have reports all over the Spanish-speaking New World, from Argentina and Chile in the south of America to parts of the United States up in the north.
Now, the reports that we've had over the hundreds of years of vampire-type activity that were attributed to vampire-type humans, might people have been mistaken and they actually witnessed perhaps a chupacabra-type vampire, be it Transylvania in Europe or any other region of this country, this world?
Yeah, very much so. But the idea that vampires are humans is actually, again, it's a fallacy, because the image of the vampire has changed an awful lot over the last couple of hundred years. If you look at the reports before about 1850, let's just stick at the European reports.
Sure.
The original European reports were of these attacks being carried out by a sort of amorphous grey giant ghost type figure. Then in, I think it was 1855, might have been a few years later, the first of the Victorian pulp fiction novels. They were called penny dreadfuls because they were printed on dreadful quality paper with bad spelling, and they only cost a penny a time. About vampires was published. It was called Vani the Vampire. Then a few years later, Bram Stoker wrote his classic book Dracula, and the image in people's eyes of the vampire changed from being this amorphous grey ghost to being a frightening old man who was a Transylvanian nobleman, because Bram Stoker had brought in the stories from Transylvania of the people like Vlad the Impaler and Countess Elizabeth Bathory.
Right.
But then in the early 20th century, the image changed again, and from being the very, very wizened old man from an old noble family who spent most of his time sleeping in a coffin and could crawl up and down walls, you suddenly then had, with the advent of people like Bela Lugosi, you suddenly have the very well-known image of today of the immaculately dressed middle-aged count who goes, the people of the night, what strange music they make.
Hollywood.
And then it all changed again, because with the advent 10, 15 years ago of the books of people like Anne Rice, vampires have changed again. And in movies like Interview with a Vampire, the vampire is now sort of just portrayed a bit like a rock star, and they've taken almost the image of someone like Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones, who God knows how he's still alive after the life he's lived. But
well, they do live forever, don't they, vampires?
Well, the Stones, in a changing world, it's nice to know the things like the Rolling Stones are still with us. But the vampire's gone from being a giant grey ghost that fed on the souls of dying soldiers in wars between the Turks and the Christians in Eastern Europe, to being a nobleman, to being a sort of wasted rock star type person.
Well,
and no doubt the image will change again.
And in some cases, Jonathan, almost a romantic type figure.
Well, It has been ever since about 1850. To be quite honest, they've been seen as romantic figures ever since people realized they could make money out of them.
So it's entirely possible then all of this was blown out of proportion, and the real stories were actually chupacabras, and we'll get into the description and some stories because you have some incredible stories of chupacabras. But it's very possible then people witnessed chupacabras, and then all of this got blown out of proportion.
To a certain extent, yeah, but the image of the chupacabra, and like I said, we'll go into this in a minute, is a particularly Latin American thing. My personal belief is that when people are confronted with something like this, they are confronted something which their brain just cannot comprehend. And so the brain sort of fills in the gaps and interprets what they're seeing in the way that their cultural background has prepared them for. And the cultural background through Latin America for the last 10-15 years has been of this weird creature with the spines up its back.
How tall are the reports, most reports, of the chupacabra?
Between 4 and 5 feet on the whole. You're talking about a bipedal creature which a friend of mine once described it as looking like the computer game Sonic the Hedgehog if you were on acid.
Yeah.
It's like a sort of bipedal creature, like a 4 to 5 foot tall kangaroo-like thing without a tail, with weird spines up the back, with two small front legs and bigger back legs, and being usually a grayish-blue or a grayish-brown in color. When I was in Puerto Rico, it was described to me very graphically as being the color of the skin on a dead dog.
Now, the head, did it look like a kangaroo head, or did it have a different kind of look?
It looked like a weird cross between an insect's head, a bit like the head of a praying mantis, and a kangaroo's head, and one of the images of the grey alien that, again, had proliferated since the Whitley Strieber books 15-20 years ago, the classic image of the grey alien.
Can you rule out that this is an alien entity as opposed to something that has been earthbound?
Well, it depends on your definition of alien. It's very much an alien entity in that it is something which is completely alien to conventional science and alien to conventional zoology.
How about extraterrestrial?
I don't believe that it is alien in that it comes from another planet.
Ah, okay.
Because I don't believe you need to actually bring other planets into any of this in order to be able to find explanations for any of the foreseen phenomena which happen on the world. I mean, I think there are Earth-bound explanations for them all.
All right, stay with us, Jonathan. We'll be right back with you, Jonathan Downs, as we try to unravel the mystery of the chupacabra. I'm George Norrie, and you are listening worldwide tonight to Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server.
Can see me through the light.
Presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And my guest this hour, Jonathan Down, is live from the United Kingdom. Next hour, we will be talking with one of Britain's few professional cryptozoologists, Richard Freeman, about some of his investigations and travels, which include looking for ape men. Huge. I'm talking about massive snakes and other very spooky things. We'll be doing that with Richard at the top of the hour. And then in the third hour, Jonathan and Richard will be along with your phone calls. And we will chat with them about some of the things that they have investigated and traveled. I mean, they've got just an incredible, incredible array of stories. The After Dark newsletter, the March issue, is being worked on. It's tsunamis. That's the main topic. But it's also about reincarnation, water witching, and DNA engineering. You can also take advantage, while you can, of the free CD, one of Art Bell's interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin. The CD is yours free when you order the After Dark newsletter. It's on exorcisms. Couple ways to order, of course. Toll free, 1-888-727-5505. The other way, of course, is coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast along with Jonathan Downs. Jonathan, the description of the praying mantis type head on one of these chupacabras, that's kind of scary.
Oh, the whole thing's very scary. I must admit that when I went out there, I didn't believe in the chupacabra. At the time, I don't know if you've ever been to England in the winter, but England in the winter is not a nice place to be.
No, not at
all. It was the middle of the winter in 1997-1998, and a British TV company said to me, would I like to go and spend a month out in tropical Central America, all expenses paid, rather than spend a winter in England? And I said, yeah, of course I would. Anything to get out of the cold, wet, and grey of an English winter. So I went along, to be quite honest, not believing anything about the chupacabra. But after only a few days out there, I was touched by the level of fear which these people in the remote villages were feeling. And within a week, I was a firm believer. And I was totally terrified. It's a very, very, very frightening phenomenon.
Is this a vicious creature?
Vicious, yeah. Now, that's a damn good question. Vicious... I suppose it is, yes. It's not vicious in the way that a vicious human being is, but it is such a implacable predator. It is something so beyond our normal comprehension as zoologists that it's very, very scary. And having seen what it can do to domestic livestock, yeah, it is vicious, yes.
I was going to ask you, Jonathan, what types of animals does it go after? What, you know, is its prey?
Now, basically, it's domestic livestock. Both large things like sheep, goats, and cattle, and small things like chickens, poultry, ducks, guinea pigs, rabbits. There have been accounts of it attacking people, but although I'm not prepared to dismiss those accounts, the three reports which I have personally investigated of attacks on people, I was not convinced by. But I'm not prepared. I'm not going to say that they have never attacked people.
When you say you weren't convinced by it, was it because of the authenticity of the person making the report? Perhaps you didn't find the kind of evidence you needed to find. What was that? What made you hedge a little bit with these reports?
I wasn't impressed by the authenticity either of the people who claimed to have been attacked or by the or of the investigators who actually dealt with the case. I felt that in each of the three cases which I personally investigated, they had their own agenda, and their whereas my agenda is purely to find out what the truth is. I don't go into any investigation with the idea that I'm trying to bolster up any particular theory or any particular intellectual mindset. The whole job of the Center for Fortean Zoology is to find out the truth behind a particular incident. And nine times out of ten, the truth turns out to be something particularly mundane. And in each of the cases where I investigated so-called attacks on people, the people involved were... I felt that they had a particular agenda, which had clouded their judgment in what actually happened.
Does this creature swoop down on a farm, let's say, grab the livestock, take it away, eat it, or does it eat it on the scene? How does it attack?
It attacks on the scene. Now, the two most important cases which I investigated, one was in Puerto Rico and one was in Mexico. And if I may, I'll do the Puerto Rico one first.
Okay.
It was a little farm where they breed roosters for cockfighting. Now, I hate blood sports. I don't approve of blood sports at all, but I'm not one of these horrible middle-class Englishmen who goes to another country and tells people how they're supposed to live their lives.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, though. I don't like them either.
So I went in there, and I spoke to the man who owned the farm. I met him, a guy called Oscar, and he told me how 2 days before, 28 roosters, which had been his prize-winning roosters, the best of his stock, had been attacked by chupacabra in the middle of the night, and this thing had come in. It had twisted the metal on the cages. And these were quite substantial cages. They were made of the sort of wire which you have around tennis courts. And I don't know what that sort of wire is, but it's not just ordinary chicken mesh.
Well, I'm not sure a man could do that.
I'm not sure a man could do it. I certainly couldn't.
Yeah.
And these things have all been attacked and drained of blood. And I was lucky enough, because it's the tropics, they buried most of the bodies. But there was one left, and I actually did an autopsy on it. Now, I've cut up bodies, and I've been doing this as a hobby for many years. Even when I was a kid, I was fascinated by animals, and I've been cutting up dead animals since I was a little boy. And I've cut up everything from the size of an earthworm to the size of a whale. And although I've never actually cut up a human being, I've been present at a human being's autopsy. I know my way around dead bodies.
Jonathan, quite a hobby, huh?
Why do you think I'm still single, you know? You go onto a dating site on the internet and they say, "Hi, what are your hobbies?" Because I cut up dead bodies. And suddenly the chicks disappear. So, I mean, if there's any girls out there listening to the show who actually want to date a fat man who likes cutting up dead bodies, hey, get my phone number from George. But one of the interesting things is as soon as an animal dies in the tropics, the micro-predators, the burying beetles, the blowflies, they all move in within minutes of death. And this thing was 2 days after it had died. And the most striking thing was that there was no micro-predation. The only entry or exit wounds on the body were a hole about the size of my little finger in the chest bone, in the breastbone,
mm-hmm.
and ribcage. Too early in the morning in England here. And a tiny puncture wound in the neck. And whereas normally with a dead body that's been out in the tropical heat for 2 days, it's expected to be riddled with little holes from predatory insects, there was nothing. It was almost as if the insects, the micro-predators in the area knew that the body was poison, they wouldn't touch it. When I opened this thing up, I found it was completely drained of blood. And it had been laying for 2 days on very dry, fine sand, very fine, dry, dusty dirt, and there was no blood on the ground, no blood on any of the dead leaves, and there was no blood in the body. Then when I opened up the body cavity, there was a connecting membrane between the body cavity and the chest cavity, which was unbroken. And there were no holes in the body cavity, but the liver was missing. And I have absolutely no explanation for this. This is something completely beyond my understanding as a zoologist.
Indeed.
Then a few weeks later, I was in Mexico, and I saw a piece of horribly frightening film. Back in 1996, in July 1996, there was a little farm in the middle of the Puebla desert which was attacked, and two sheep and a goat had been attacked by this thing. 11 hours later, 11 hours after the attack, the vet finally turned up. The vet had been called to sign the insurance documents, and this is the frightening thing. These three animals were still alive. 11 hours after the attack, she shot two of them immediately to put them out of their misery. But the third one, I've got this on video, and the creature was completely drained of blood, but it was still alive. It was staggering around. It was still reacting to light. It was still reacting to touch. But this vet, a very pretty girl called Soledad de la Peña, put a white cotton glove on her hand, made her hand into a fist, and put this fist into the hole in the side of the thoracic cavity, and put her whole fist inside, and took it out again, and there was no blood on the no blood on her hand. The whole body was completely drained of blood, and according to the autopsy report, again the liver had been removed, and this is something which is completely beyond not just my comprehension, but the comprehension of any orthodox zoology. This is something which logically cannot happen, cannot exist, but I know it does exist. So we have to rewrite the rule book.
Does it appear that the chupacabras then take out, however they do it, the liver from these domestic animals that they attack?
All the blood and usually the liver, yes.
So what is it about the liver that they want so much? They must need something for their nutrition in their bodies.
I would love to be able to answer that question with a snappy answer, but the truth is we just don't know. I mean, we are right at the beginning of that. This is right at the beginning of treating vampire research as a serious branch of science, rather than something which lunatics wearing silly clothes hang around in graveyards at night do. This is just we're right at the beginning of vampirology as a serious science. And the truth is, I really don't know the answer.
Might there be any tie-in between the chupacabra attacks and what we have been known to know as cattle mutilations?
Yes, in many ways, I think it's all part of the same phenomenon. I just think that these things are perceived as being this weird kangaroo-like creature purely because that's something deep in the Latin American ethos. I think it's part of the global animal mutilation phenomenon, and I've investigated animal mutilations in America, in Mexico, and in the UK.
Jonathan, has anybody reported on sounds that they might emit?
Not to my knowledge. That's not to say that they haven't, but I haven't heard anything of that.
So we don't know about screeches or any kind of animal noise that they might make?
I have heard there are a couple of websites on the internet where you can download wave files, which are supposedly chupacabra noises, but each time I've heard them, they either sound like crude fakes that have been made on the synthesizer, or they sound like owls to me. There's nothing which I haven't been able to explain that I've ever heard.
What about reports of how they move? I mean, do they hop like kangaroos, or do they run like human beings?
Sort of half and half. Somewhere between, they scuttle more. And then the best description I ever had was from a lad that I met in Mexico who'd actually seen this thing. And it turned out he was a fan of computer video games. And he said that it was like one of the characters. I don't know if you've ever seen a video game called Doom.
Yes.
But if you play Doom online with another person, rather than playing it against the monsters which the computer generates, if you're controlling one of the people yourself, it sort of scuttles along, sort of halfway between like an insect and like a person. And it was just the person who I was talking to described it as being like that.
Is it possible, Jonathan, that the chupacabra has been mistaken for perhaps a smaller Bigfoot?
Unlikely most of the time, but it's interesting to say that because when I was in Florida, there were I was investigating a series of events that happened in Sweetwater, which the local people believed were indeed chupacabra attacks, but they sounded much more like attacks by a creature that's known as the skunk ape.
Okay, yes, you're right.
Which is the southern United States smaller version of Bigfoot. Now, this is where it gets really weird, because these attacks took place in the garden of an old people family, so that's on the outskirts of the on the edges of the Everglades by Sweetwater. And the old lady who'd seen the creature described it to me as looking like a cross between a monkey and a dog. Well, zoologically, a monkey and a dog could never breed, and they're too far apart genetically. But she'd taken some plaster casts of footprints when this thing had scuttled through some builder's sand. And I've got one of these footprints, and she showed me this footprint, she gave it to me to take home. And I looked at it politely. I thought, to be quite honest, it looked like a big dog footprint. But I brought it back home to my office back in England, and I showed it to Richard, who's on the show next. And he pointed out to me that it wasn't a dog footprint. Although the pads looked like they were from a dog, it didn't have it didn't have claws like a dog has. It had fingernails like an ape or a human. And so it's interesting that the woman said it, that the thing she saw looked halfway between a dog and a monkey or an ape. And the footprints actually are like a weird chimera, a weird combination of the two types of creature. So yeah, there is a certain amount of a crossover, yes.
Okay, so other than the liver being removed and the blood being sucked entirely from these animals' bodies, the chupacabra is not tearing the meat, eating it, or anything like that, right?
No, as far as we can see, not at all. The only times... The other problem is, though, that the word chupacabra over the last 10 years has become synonymous with all sorts of other monsters. It's become used almost like a term, like a bogeyman. And so in more recent years, especially in Chile and Argentina, sightings of strange creatures and anomalous attacks on livestock have been blamed on the chupacabra, when in fact they're probably actually something completely different. But the true chupacabra attacks, yeah, it's just purely they drink the blood, or they take the blood, I assume that they drink it, and that the liver is missing. That's the only damage.
Jonathan, in your opinion, what kind of creature do you think this chupacabra might be?
That's the million-dollar question. I don't believe that it is a conventional animal. I don't believe it's an animal in the same way that you're an animal, I'm an animal, mm-hmm. My pet dog's an animal. I don't think that it is a normal carbon-based life form. I think it is something more paranormal, something more...
dimensional? From another dimension?
Possibly from another dimension, possibly something which exists in this dimension, but doesn't have the same sort of objective reality as ordinary carbon-based life forms like you and I have. Something that's real, that's there some of the time, but not there all of the time. Something which drifts in and out, that somehow comes between dimensions or between different levels of reality. And I'm sorry, I know that's not a very satisfactory answer, but it's probably the best I can give at the moment.
Well, and to an expert, it illustrates just how very strange this creature really is.
Oh, Lord, yeah. I mean, 90% of what I do as a cryptozoologist is dealing with straightforward, ordinary animals. But you have this odd 10% of stuff, like the chupacabra, which is not explainable within a normal zoological framework. But I am a scientist, and I'm not going to say, oh, these things can't exist because they don't exist within the framework of what I know and what I understand. These things do exist, but they're outside the framework of what, at the moment, conventional science understands.
Well, and that may explain why we have not found any bones of chupacabras, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there have been several dead bodies and several... sets of bones found, but in each occasion it turned out to be something else.
All right, Jonathan. Next hour, of course, we'll have your partner Richard Freeman joining us, and you'll be back with us in the hour after next as we take phone calls with coast-to-coast listeners. So just enjoy, and we'll be right back with you, Jonathan Downs, in about an hour. Richard Freeman will be coming up next. We'll continue to talk with him about their investigations, their travels into cryptozoology, and that includes looking for huge snakes. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Can't believe what you're hearing? Listen to it again when you sign up for StreamLink at www.coasttocoastam.com. It's only 15 cents a day. With George Norrie.
Indeed, and in a moment, our guest this hour will be Richard Freeman. He, of course, works with our dear friend Jonathan Downs. Richard is one of Britain's few professional cryptozoologists. We'll be back with him and his stories in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Freeman is one of Britain's few professional cryptozoologists. His interest in unknown animals reaches back to his childhood, and he has had a long and varied career working with exotic animals. He has worked as a zookeeper in the Midlands, where he became head curator of reptiles, worked in several specialist pet shops, and worked in an animal sanctuary. In 1996, he took a degree in zoology at Leeds University, then moved to Exeter to work full-time at the Center for Fortean Zoology. In October 2000, he visited the remote jungles, rivers, caves of northern Thailand in search of the Naga, a giant crested serpent said to lurk in the morasses of Indochina, and explored deep caves never visited by Westerners before. And he's currently working on a book on one of my passions, by the way, Dragon Legends Worldwide. This hour, Richard Freeman on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
What a great career you have.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
I like it. I like it a lot. Have you ever, in the research you did for the book on dragons, were you ever able to ascertain if it's myth or real?
It's real. They think that the dragon legend is found in every single culture. It goes back at least 25,000 years. There are cave paintings of dragons. They're found all over the world. So the dragon legend has a basis very much in fact rather than mythology.
In terms of how people have described dragons, Richard, with a winged creatures, sometimes they can breathe fire. Do you think that happened?
Well, dragon is a term, a bit of an umbrella term. It's applied to all sorts of creatures. That the only hard and fast rule is that they're reptiles. They're not even always huge. Some dragons, like the basilisk, were quite small. The classic fire-breathing dragon that we think about in the West, the winged fire-breathing dragon,
that, one of the theories about that is that it may have evolved from carnivorous dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus rex, and it flew by the manipulation of lighter than air gas in a large stomach. The wings would have been an extended rib cage, and these creatures were basically like living Hindenburgs. That's one theory. But we associate dragons with fire in the West.
Yes.
The most ancient dragon legends from Babylon, Sumeria, and then from ancient China associate them with water. They're always associated with water.
In terms of their ability to have wings, I mean, do you think that they could actually fly great distances and heights?
Some of them, yes. So some of the winged ones, certainly. The theory about the manipulation of gas, they would have flown by extending this great chambered stomach, filling themselves up with hydrogen, and floating rather than flying. We know that some of the prehistoric reptiles, flying reptiles, grew to huge sizes. The pterosaurs, the largest of them, Quetzalcoatlus, whose remains have been found in Texas, that had a wingspan of 40 feet. So we know that very large animals can fly.
I can tell you, in Alton, Illinois, overlooking the Mississippi, along the River Rocks, there is a painted picture, a huge one, of what they call, Richard, the Piesaw bird. And ancient Indian legend says that this bird, of course, some could have called it a thunderbird. But when you look at the picture, it looks pretty close to what a dragon could have looked like with that body shape and those wings and those clawed feet. Now that you talk about dragons, I'm wondering if indeed that's what those Indians at this time might have witnessed.
Quite possibly, yes. I'm familiar with the painting. The original one was actually destroyed, wasn't it?
And yes.
They painted another one on later. Yes, there are a lot of dragon legends in the Americas. Everything from Quetzalcoatl, the winged serpent of the Aztecs. There are lots of lake-dwelling horned serpents, and there are the thunderbirds. And the thunderbirds seem to be broken into two types, one of them which describes some sort of huge feathered bird, and the other one which describes a reptilian monster with a beak and fangs and claws and leathery wings rather than feathery ones.
So myths might be real, you know?
Yes, they might.
How did you, since your childhood, how did all this fascination for zoology occur?
Well, I can answer that in two words for you. Doctor Who, the greatest science fiction serial of all time. When I was a boy, there was an actor called John Pertwee playing the role of the Doctor, and he had been incarcerated on Earth by the Time Lords. If you're not familiar with Doctor Who, it's a science fiction serial where the hero called the Doctor, who's a Time Lord, he travels through time and space fighting evil and injustice. But in this particular period, he was trapped on Earth by his own race, the Time Lords. So all of the monsters and the strange things he faced were on Earth. And because they were on Earth in a familiar 20th century setting, it made them all the more frightening. You had stories about disembodied alien entities that could enter plastic and animate it. So you had such shop room dummies smashing out of windows and attacking people and children's dolls coming to life. You had stories about super intelligent marine reptiles waking up from millions of years of hibernation and finding that upstart apes have claimed the Earth for their own and then trying to wipe them out. Fabulous, fabulous series. And this first got me interested in monsters. And I studied animals, both known animals and unknown animals, since I was a boy, read all the literature I could get on strange beasts. When I left school, I became a zookeeper, specialised in reptiles, and then I ended up at the Centre for 14 Zoology eventually, which is the only full-time, 24/7 cryptozoological organisation in the world.
Was there any one particular creature that fascinated you the most?
It's always been the dragon. Being a reptile buff, a herpetologist,
yeah.
The dragon legend has always fascinated me more than anything else. But I'm interested in all mystery animals. The marsupial wolf, or thylacine, of Tasmania and Australia, that is another absolutely fascinating creature, and one that almost certainly still exists.
With cryptozoology, is it a search for animals, creatures that we know exist, or is it a search for animals that are also part myth, and we just aren't quite sure?
It's both, really. With the example of the psilocybin that I just gave you, we know that animal existed. It was a carnivorous marsupial that looked rather like a wolf, but it had stripes along its flanks like a tiger. But it, of course, it was a marsupial. It raised its young in a pouch. Its closest relative is the Tasmanian devil. Now, these things were supposed to have been extinct since the 1930s. They were persecuted by white settlers because they attacked sheep. The last one was supposed to have died in a zoo in Hobart, in Tasmania, in 1936. But there have been consistent reports of sightings ever since, both on Tasmania and on mainland Australia and in New Guinea. And these have been seen by park rangers and zoologists. They've even been filmed, but nobody has actually caught one yet. So that's an animal we know exists. Officially, it's declared extinct, but it's almost certainly still around. So that's an example of one that we know exists. And of course, there are other things. There are things that are known only from anecdotal evidence, like sea serpents and so on. But they're seen consistently all around the world. That's an example of probably several different types of animal that we just don't know about.
Well, give me a list of the creatures that you have gone searching for, Richard, you and Jonathan as well.
Well, back in 2000, I went searching for the Naga, which is another type of dragon. It's a serpent dragon. You'll see them all over the temples in carvings of them in Indochina and India. And it's supposed to be a gigantic snake, far, far bigger than anything known to science. And it bears a crest on its head, rather like a cobra can open its hood when it's angry. The Naga raises up its crest. It's supposed to be able to spit poison and crush with its immense coils. And I went to Thailand to investigate reports of this, and everywhere I went, I was getting the same story all over the country. When I interviewed people, they were saying they'd seen something about 60 feet long, about as thick around as an oil drum, black, and when you got up close to it, it had a greenish sheen on it. And these details were the same everywhere, so I was convinced that they were actually seeing something. And there are reports of giant snakes in Africa, in South America, in other parts of Asia, in Australia, that are far bigger than anything we know of, far bigger than any anaconda or python. There were a group of fossil snakes called madsoyids, and these first evolved about 65 million years ago in the Cretaceous period. But in some areas, like Australia, there was a species called Wanambi that hung on until around 10,000 years ago, which in geological terms is nothing. It's an eye blink, a drop in the ocean. And these grew to immense sizes. So some of the vertebrae indicate they were about 60 feet long, which matches the Naga quite well. So I think in certain parts of the world, there are surviving forms of these giant fossil snakes called madsoyids.
Now, these snakes, you say, were bigger than the anaconda, and I assume the anaconda to date is the largest known snake, right?
In terms of bulk, yes. The reticulated python is longer, but it's not as bulky. But having said that, there are stories from South America of gigantic snakes. Some of them sound like outsized anacondas, which are very, very big specimens of the anaconda. Other reports sound like something entirely different. The description is completely different from the anaconda.
I saw a picture, Richard, about a massive-sized snake, might have been an anaconda, and they opened it up, and in was a complete body of a human. Is that true, or was that a hoax-type picture?
No, I think that was probably a reticulated python, if it's the same picture I'm thinking of. But from time to time, a very big snake will eat a human being. They have trouble swallowing people because we've got such wide shoulders. Most animals are down on all fours, so mm-hmm. they don't have the shoulder blades coming out from the side of the body, which makes it very difficult to swallow. So only a really big snake can swallow a human being, but it does happen from time to time.
Oh my gosh. And you know, with clothes on and shoes,
digest a lot.
They will?
Yeah, digest a lot. Reptiles have incredibly powerful digestive systems. I mean, crocodiles, when they eat people, will digest the hair, the bones, the clothes, even watches and coins that the people have in their pockets, they'll finally get digested. Even steel hooks that get swallowed by them get digested eventually.
Now, in the case of the human being swallowed by a snake whole, do these snakes always constrict the human first and then crush him and kill him, or Is the human being alive as he's being swallowed?
No, they're not alive as they're being swallowed. What they'll do, they'd bite you, whip the coils around you, and suffocate you to death. They wouldn't want to swallow something alive because it would kick about in the stomach and might damage them internally, so they kill it first.
I remember a case in the St. Louis area of a little child that was eaten by a python, and he escaped out of his cage, and the parents had the baby sleeping in the same room with the snake.
That's pretty dumb.
Yes, absolutely. It was, you know, to me, gross negligence there. And, I mean, these are animals that you don't put little children around, are they?
No, I have been attacked by a python, an 8-foot python, and its bite is incredibly painful. So, can you imagine the damage that a giant python's bite would do?
Now, when you got bitten, where did he bite you?
I've been bitten on the stomach and on the arms.
Do they let go, or do they continue
Thankfully,
to just...
They usually let go, but sometimes they hang on and you have to prise them off.
Now, did you ever see the movie Anaconda?
Yes, I did.
Real?
It was awful. Absolute garbage. Very poorly researched. Not so much in the size of the snake. They possibly do get that big or even larger. But the thing is, being a reptile, it's got a very slow metabolism, a very efficient metabolism. It gobbles its way through the entire cast, about 5 people, within a few hours. Even a very, very big snake, if it swallowed somebody, it'd be satisfied for about a week, and it'd just crawl off and digest this meal. Also, anacondas are very slow-moving on land. All big snakes, when they're on land, are fairly slow-moving. When they're in the water, they can go like grease lightning. But you could get away from an anaconda if you saw it coming on land.
Now, when you see a movie like that, that has a lot of Hollywood pizzazz to it in imagery, but it's pretty inaccurate in terms of how this animal lives out in the wild. Does it bother you at all,
yes,
as a zoologist?
It really does, because I think they'd be better off either consulting zoologists or getting zoologists to script write for them. And it'd be another very welcome piece of income for people like us as well.
When you go on your trips, has there ever been a place, Richard, that was indeed strange?
The strangest place I've been to a couple of really freaky places. One of them was these caves in Thailand, in the jungles of northern Thailand, which were totally bizarre. I was taken down there by a 70-year-old man, and it was a mountain in the jungle covered with rainforest. He crawled down into this little hole, and he took me into this bizarre network of caves, which were like nowhere else I'd ever been. It was by candlelight. Sometimes we were crouched double, sometimes we were on all fours, sometimes we were slithering along on our bellies. There were bizarre stalactite and stalagmite formations, like guillotines, and some straight like coffins, and others like Greek pillars. There were these weird, luminous insects hanging from the ceiling. It was totally unearthly. And he took me to an underground river, and he said he'd been exploring there about 10 years previously, and he'd seen one of these giant snakes crawling up by candlelight, crawling up out of this river, and he sort of pinned himself back against the wall, and it crawled very slowly past him, and he said he was close enough to have reached out and touched it, and he said it was huge. It was like a tree trunk in thickness and about 60 feet long. It's absolutely incredible. Another very, very atmospheric and strange place I've been to is when I was in Sumatra last year looking for Orang Pendek, the mystery bipedal ape of Sumatra. We went to a place called Gunung Tuju, the Lake of Seven Peaks, mm-hmm. which is an extinct volcano that's filled with water, once again in the rainforest, but at night it gets very cold because it's very, very high up. Almost killed me getting up there. I'm not very good at climbing. Yeah. I can deal with heat and I can walk for a long way through the jungle. I'm not too good at climbing.
You're a cryptozoologist, really, not a climber.
Really tires me out, yeah. But that was an absolutely magnificent place. Very, very strange. The water is an odd turquoise colour and it's warm because it's a geothermal lake. It's warm, and the only animals that live in the lake are one type of fish and one type of crab. Very strange when the mist rolls down from the mountains and it's covered with this damp, cool rainforest. And in this area is supposed to live this creature, Orang Pendek, which is supposed to be about 5 feet tall, massively powerful, very strong, walking on its hind legs, covered with hair, with a long mane of hair, and our guide was telling us about how his father had seen one a few years ago, and we interviewed lots of witnesses, and we found the creature's tracks and followed them through the jungle and photographed the tracks. It was absolutely amazing place.
Have you ever been just so frightened when you've been on an expedition where you almost said to yourself, I'm not coming back here again?
Not really. No, I've never really been frightened on an expedition. That's not the sort of thing I'm frightened of. I thought I was going to have a heart attack halfway up this mountain through exhaustion, but I've never been afraid of the creatures I'm hunting. Never.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Of everything that you have searched for in your whole repertoire of creatures, which one might be your favorite?
Oh, that's hard to say. The two things I'm interested in most are dragons, which include all sorts of things from giant lizards and giant crocodiles to genuine unknown creatures, and also the Tasmanian wolf, which has always been one of my favourite animals, and it's one that I'm completely sure still exists, the marsupial wolf of Tasmania. The things I've been looking for personally, I find the Naga very, very fascinating. I'm sure that exists. And I'm pretty sure Orang Pendek exists as well.
All right, stay with us, Richard. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Right here on Coast to Coast AM, we'll continue our dialogue. Top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines.
Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Top of the hour, we're going to open up the phone lines with Jonathan Downs and Richard Freeman. We'll continue chatting with Richard. His website, which is the same as Jonathan's, linked up with coasttocoastam.com at cfz.org.uk. I'm telling you, some fascinating stories there and some great video. Take a look at the Nessie video, by the way. And I have a fast blast in, which I'm going to chat with Richard about in a moment. Rumors of 30-foot-long centipedes in the jungles of Indonesia. Can this be true? Well, we'll find out if Richard knows anything about it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And this is Coast to Coast AM with Richard Freeman, cryptozoologist. I'm George Norrie. Richard, possible to have a 30-foot centipede in Indonesia? Have you heard anything about this?
I've not. I've heard of giant crocodiles and giant snakes, but never giant centipedes. It's highly unlikely for the following reasons. Centipedes are arthropods. They have an external exoskeleton, and that's only practical up to a certain size. After that, after a certain size, it gets too heavy. Also, they breathe by a series of tubes called spiracles. And these spiracles, they don't actually have lungs like we have. The air diffuses from the outside down these tubes into other tubes all over the body. And once again, that's only efficient up to a certain size, because if you get above a certain body size, then the air doesn't diffuse deficiently, unlike higher animals that actually suck it in and pump the air around them. So that's why you can't get things like scorpions and spiders, the size of which that is beloved of horror movie makers like Ray Harryhausen.
So we don't have 2 foot long ants as well, right?
Yeah, that's why.
Have you though ever seen an insect which was much larger in the foreign countries than, let's say, we would have in England or the United States?
Oh, absolutely. When I was in Sumatra, I saw enormous bees. We called them B-52s, but they were the size of small mice.
That's good. That's a big bee.
And, yeah, we saw enormous hornets that were about the size of my index finger, 2.5-3 inches long. God alone knows what their sting would have been like. Thankfully, we didn't find out.
It could have killed you, I believe, if you had gotten stung.
Especially if you were allergic to the venom.
Absolutely. Where do your continual travels take you to next?
Well, I'm going back to Sumatra around about May to look for Orang Pendek again. And later in the year, I'm going into the swamplands of Texas to look for the skunk ape. And next year, hopefully, knock on wood, I'm off to Mongolia to try and catch specimens of the Mongolian death worm and bring them back to England alive.
Tell me about this in Mongolia. What is this?
The Mongolian death worm. The natives call it Alagoy Korkoy, which means intestine worm, because they say it looks like a length of cow's intestine. It's about a meter long, about 3.5 feet long, about as thick as your arm. Well, thick as the average arm, not as thick as Arnold Schwarzenegger's arm. A bright blood red. It's said to burrow under the sands of the southern Gobi Desert, and it comes to the surface only in the hottest months, which is May, June, and July. And the nomads there go in great fear of it, because they say it can kill in two different ways. It can generate a blast of electricity, rather like an electric eel. And there are stories of camels having trodden on this thing and then collapsed dead because of the electrical blast. Now, human beings are supposed to have been killed by it as well in this way. There was one story of a geologist who was poking a metal bar into some sand dunes, and he suddenly collapsed dead, and his colleagues saw one of these things slithering away through the dunes. It's also meant to be able to spit a yellow corrosive substance that's akin to acid, and anybody that is burnt by this stuff, their skin turns yellow and they die. It's highly unlikely to be a true annelid worm, because it's far, far too dry, far too arid in the desert for a worm, so it's more likely to be some sort of reptile. I think it belongs to a group of creatures called amphisodaenas, or worm lizards. The name is deceptive. They're not really lizards, they're not worms, they're not snakes either. They're sort of salami-shaped reptiles that are usually quite small and live in arid areas. You get them in the United States, in the southern states. They're pretty widespread, but I think this is a giant specimen, a giant species unknown to science. And I also think the stories about it spitting acid and generating blasts of electricity are probably apocryphal, rather like the salamander in ancient Europe, a fairly harmless amphibian. In medieval Europe, it's thought to be absolutely lethal. It's thought to be deadly poisonous. Alexander the Great is supposed to have lost thousands of men and horses because they drunk from a stream where a salamander had crawled through it. And now we know that salamander is a fairly innocuous animal. And I think the same is true about the death worm. I mean, these stories are probably apocryphal. And I'm going to put it to the test, because I'm going to try and catch some.
This could be purely speculative, but how many creatures do you think are on this planet now, Richard, that we have not ever found or identified? Not little organisms or funny things that might live on the bottom of the ocean, but actual creatures that have...
You're talking about fairly large animals.
Yeah.
Good Lord, that's a very good question. I would say at the least 100, at the very least, and probably a damn sight more.
Oh my, that's a lot. Especially since the beginning of mankind, and who knows how many creatures there might be in different regions. Do you think that most of these creatures are in obscure places on this planet?
Most of them are in out-of-the-way places, but how do you find an out-of-the-way place? If you look if you look on a map of the world, you'll find there are, the majority of the world is very sparsely populated. There are great tracts of Asia, huge places in Siberia, for instance, and in Central Asia, in Australia, where nobody lives at all, or very, very few people live. The jungles of Central Africa, South America. The majority of the world is not well explored. We have this fallacy that the world is crisscrossed by roads, and we've explored everywhere. I mean, even in a small island like Tasmania, which is only about the size of Scotland, there are huge areas of that where you look on the maps, you look on detailed maps, it says insufficient data. Nobody's ever mapped it properly.
I wonder if we truly start investigating Mars in a very big way, if we'll ever find some of these strange-looking type creatures, maybe like worms that you've just described, on a planet like that.
Yeah, I think if there is any... there was any life on Mars. I think it's probably going to be single-celled life forms. I'd love to be proved wrong, but hang on. Mars heated up and cooled down so quickly, I don't think complex life would have had time to have evolved. So I think if we do find traces of life on Mars, it will be very, very primitive stuff.
Do you think any of these creatures, the reptiles in some of the creatures you investigate, might have more brain power than we have given them credit for?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Intelligence is a very, very awkward thing to measure because human beings are very narcissistic and they'll measure things by their own yardstick from their own perspective. Each animal is uniquely adapted in its own way, so the idea of comparative intelligence is really a red herring. But they're cunning enough to have evaded capture.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Richard.
For a very long time. Here in the UK, we have big cats that shouldn't be here. We have the North American puma, we have the leopard, the black leopard or panther from Asia and Africa, and lots of smaller ones like lynx and jungle cats and so forth. They have been living and breeding in Britain for years and years and years now, and it's very rare that they're even photographed or filmed. We've only caught a handful of them, and that's in a tiny little country like Britain, which you could fit several times into Texas.
Give me your take on what you think Bigfoot might be.
Bigfoot? I'm more inclined to believe in the Asian hominids, the Yeti, the Chinese Yeren, Orang Pendek, the Almas. If Bigfoot exists, that's a big if, because there have never been any primate fossils other than human beings in North America, and never any ape fossils from either North America or South America. If Bigfoot exists, and it's a flesh and blood animal rather than some sort of paranormal manifestation, which it could well be, I think it would be very closely related, if not the same creature, as the Himalayan Yeti and the Chinese Yeren, a very powerful, bipedal, upright walking ape, almost certainly a descendant of something called Gigantopithecus Black Eye.
Yes.
Gigantopithecus Black Eye was a giant fossil ape from the Pleistocene epoch. Its fossils are around 500,000 years old. They've been found in India and China. It's mainly known from jaw bones and teeth, but we've reconstructed a skull from these, and we think it was a biped walking erect on its hind legs. It was considerably bigger than the mountain gorilla, possibly as much as 3 meters or 10 feet tall. and it had these great powerful jaws and teeth for masticating bamboo. The bulk of its diet would have been tough fibrous substances like bamboo, also fruits like durian and so forth. This lived in the tropics and the semi-tropics. So it was found alongside other animals like Asian rhinos, pandas, Asian elephants, tapirs, all of which are still around today. So there's no good reason why Gigantopithecus shouldn't still be surviving. And there are these reports from Asia of these giant hairy bipeds. It's not impossible that they could have gone across the Bering Strait when it was all one landmass and gotten into North America, but why they would have done it, why they'd have left the tropics and the semi-tropics to go up to a much cooler region, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't it that we have not found bones or any kind of evidence like that, or have we?
Well, for the Asian Yeti, we have. There was an alleged mummified Yeti hand kept in a monastery in Nepal called Pangboche, that's it, yes.
A hand.
Pangboche, it's called the Pangboche hand, and it was a relic kept in this monastery. And there was a British zoologist called Peter Byrne, and he examined it, and he asked the monks, could he take some of the bones back to England to be looked at by scientists? And the monk said, oh no, this is a holy relic. So he got the guy who was guarding it drunk on Himalayan beer and stole some of the bones from this hand and replaced them with human bones. And he took these bones back to England. And they were examined by an anthropologist called Dr. W.C. Osmond Hill, who said that they belonged to some sort of gigantic anthropoid, much bigger than the mountain gorilla. And actually, the guy who smuggled them out of Nepal and into England was none other than the actor Jimmy Stewart, who was a friend of Peter Byrne. Yeah. And they were examined by several specialists who came to the conclusion that it was from some huge unknown primate. But unfortunately, the bones have either been lost or stolen now. Nobody knows where they are. But the papers written by these experts are still in existence. Also, we've got hair from Hubei province in central China, which is supposed to be from the Yeren, which is the Chinese word for the Yeti.
Has it been analyzed?
That's been analyzed in China, in England, and in the US. And what they did was they bombarded it with protons and saw how they reacted with the different chemicals and elements in the hair. I mean, I'm not a physicist, I couldn't tell you how all this works, but they found it had a very high zinc and carbon ratio in it, and it was completely unlike anything else. And once again, they looked at the scale arrangement as well, and they all came to the conclusion it's some sort of primate, but unknown to science.
Do you think we'd be more apt, Richard, to find some of these unknown creatures in areas like the Congo in Brazil, heavily forest?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. The Congo is one of the places I most want to go, but it is so politically unstable at the minute. It's so dangerous. I wouldn't be frightened of going into the Congo because I was going to get eaten by a crocodile. That's a natural hazard. I don't fancy getting shot at by lunatics with machine guns high on drugs. But the creature they have in the Congo, they have many creatures in the Congo, unknown to science. One of them is Makolia Mbembe, which people insist is a sauropod dinosaur, one of the long-necked herbivorous dinosaurs, but it's much more likely to be a gigantic monitor lizard, semi-aquatic monitor lizard. They also have something called a Melanotoca, the killer of elephants, which is a huge four-footed animal with a horn that lives in the swamps. It's said to gore hippopotamus and elephants to death, this horn. Once again, people have been obsessed that it's a horned dinosaur like Monoclonius or Triceratops. It's probably actually a semi-aquatic rhino of some sort, but still very, very fascinating and unknown to science.
I just think your whole field of cryptozoology is just utterly fascinating. I mean, there's no end to it, is there?
No, there's not. There's all sorts of things. In Australia, there are reports of a 30-foot lizard, similar to the Komodo dragon, but three times as big, the size of a bus, living in the outback.
And, I mean, that could attack a human. That could swallow a human being.
Yeah, it's about the same size as a big Indo-Pacific crocodile, about 30 feet long. But once again, we have fossils of something called Megalania prisca, which was a giant relative of the Komodo dragon that lived on mainland Australia until about 10,000 years ago, preying on the giant marsupials that lived there, and we think maybe this thing has survived. Recently, part of a hip bone of this creature was found, and it wasn't fossilized, and some of the people that looked at it, it was subfossil rather than true fossil. Some of the experts that looked at it, like Dr. Ralph Molnar, they declared it could be as young as 100 years old. This is an animal we thought died out at least 10,000 years ago.
What are the possibilities that some of these huge creatures, Richard, might be radioactive monsters that some kind of, you know, deformity here?
Like the 50s B-movies.
Yes.
Radiation in large doses is more likely to kill things rather than make them grow huge, unfortunately. I think most of them are naturally occurring creatures that we just don't know about. And the sad thing is, there's so much out there to look for, but nobody's interested in sponsoring us. TV companies aren't interested in at all.
Why not?
I'll give you a couple of examples.
These would be great journeys.
Sorry?
These would be great journeys.
They'd be great documentaries. But recently we were contacted by some people that wanted to do something up at Loch Ness, and we told them about the theory of the Loch Ness monster being a giant eel and how we could bait it out using sacks full of offal attached to buoys. So you float them out on the lock, and if one of them were yanked underwater, you'd know that it was something much more big and much more powerful than it should be in the lock.
They said it was for a
program on British cable television about the paranormal. They said it was, quote, too real. It didn't fit in with the rest of the show, which was about guardian angels and aliens and healing crystals. They said it was too real, it didn't fit in.
They didn't want an answer to the possible truth,
exactly.
Did they?
Exactly. And the BBC contacted us last year, and this is the cheekiest thing I've ever heard. The BBC contacted us, one of their researchers asked us to finance an expedition ourselves, let them come along on it and film it and get a documentary out of it, and they weren't going to give us anything for it.
No, that's disappointing. How about National Geographic? Any luck there?
No one seems interested. We almost always finance our own expeditions. We try to do one big foreign expedition every year and several smaller ones in the UK. The last time a TV company was involved was back in 2000 when I did the Naga, and then that was the Discovery Channel. I did it for a program called Asian Enigmas.
Have you seen any good documentary on the chupacabras? Has that been done yet?
Yeah, John and Graham did a documentary on the chupacabra back, I think it was in 96. But
was it picked up by television?
98, yeah. Yeah, it was shown over here. I don't know if it was shown in America. But unfortunately, the producer of that wasn't very interested in finding the monster.
No, that's disappointing.
He's more interested in doing silly jokes, like putting John, who's 6'7", in a very small car, then pretending it breaks down and spending all day setting up shots, rather than interviewing people, doing post-mortems on animals that the chupacabra has attacked and so forth.
All right, stay with us, Richard. When we come right back, the first half of the hour, phone calls with Jonathan Downs and your calls, and then Richard will come back at the half-hour mark. He'll take calls, too.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Keep on moving.
George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Now, the dodo bird is extinct, but I swear I saw a story somewhere that they were going to try to clone him or pull him back from the dead. I've got to check with Jonathan Downs on that, and we'll take your phone calls. And in the latter half of this hour, Richard Freeman will come back. He'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Cryptozoology, my guest, Jonathan Downs, this half hour with your phone call. Jonathan, the dodo bird, I'm beginning to sound like one here, the dodo bird is extinct, right?
Yes, supposedly, yes.
Now, I had seen somewhere that some scientists and biologists were going to try to clone something to get the dodo bird back. Did you see anything like that, or am I dreaming?
I'm not sure about them doing it with a dodo, but they are trying. There is quite a lot of talk, but they're trying to do it with another extinct bird, the moa, which was an ostrich-like bird from New Zealand, which has been extinct for several hundred years. There were a lot of different sorts of moas, and they ranged from something the size of a turkey to something much bigger than an ostrich. And there has been quite a lot of talk about trying to get the mitochondrial DNA from moas and to implant them to turkey eggs and to try to resurrect the species through cloning. And there's also talk about trying to resurrect the mammoth, which became extinct thousands of years ago, but there are well preserved bodies which have been frozen in the Arctic ice, and there's talk of trying to take the mitochondrial DNA from them and put them into elephants and see if it's possible to resurrect the species that way.
Do you ever envision a Jurassic Park-type era where scientists and biologists will be able to create just about any kind of past animal if we had the ability to use some of their DNA?
It's a lovely idea, and I would love it to happen. I wouldn't be surprised if eventually the technology exists to be able to do it. At the moment, we haven't got it. But it's something which, personally, I believe is well within the bounds of what's possible.
Of course, it could be dangerous, too, now. If we, let's say, create another Tyrannosaurus Rex, mankind perhaps wasn't supposed to be around when they were, it could be a problem.
Yes, that's if they got out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You ready for some phone calls?
Of course.
Let's do it. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going east of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast with Jonathan Downs. Hi there.
Hi, I'm not sure. One of your guests mentioned something about dragons, and years ago I read Job chapter 41 without a commentary. I just read the text, and I got the impression that what I was reading was a description of a fire-breathing dragon. And then I went to some commentary, and they tried to downplay it to something else, but it seems pretty clear-cut to me. It's in Job chapter 41.
I'm not sure of because I haven't actually got my Bible with me. I'm downstairs, my Bible's upstairs in my room. But if from memory, from the passage you're referring to, yes, it does very much appear like it's talking about a dragon.
Yes.
But the problem is, with so many things in the Bible, they get rewritten and reinterpreted by different generations of theologians who like to see things according to their particular mindset at the time. And we've seen in recent years people trying to reinterpret some of the most basic tenets of the Bible to suit their own mindset. And it's very, very difficult to know where to begin, really.
Well, there are some texts that are like that. I think that there is one that's been preserved. There's a book called The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop that also talks about a fire-breathing dragon in India, I think.
Yeah, it was actually Richard who was talking about fire-breathing dragons, not me.
Yeah.
But yes, I am very interested in the theories which Richard was talking about, that the scientist, whose name I can't remember, came up with the idea that they could have been a descendant of the dinosaurs that actually flew by controlling lighter than air gas, probably hydrogen, in their stomachs, and that the fire breathing was a natural part of getting rid of the excess hydrogen. It's a very interesting theory. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a very, very interesting and well thought out theory.
Jonathan, if dragons are Richard's favorite creatures, what are yours?
My favorite creatures of all are turtles. As a straightforward zoologist, it's they're things I study a lot, and I'm part of several rare breed conservation programs for unknown species of turtle. And one of the things I'm working on at the moment, which I'm going to be visiting some colleagues when I'm back in the States in June, and they're studying the reports of giant snapping turtles from the swamps in Texas and Georgia.
How big?
And there's a heck of a lot of evidence to suggest that, as well as the two species of snapping turtle which we know exist in North America, the common snapper and the alligator snapper, that there may be a third species which is much, much, much larger. And that fascinates me. I love turtles. Wonderful things.
And how big would a giant snapping turtle be?
There's evidence that there could be ones whose shells are anything up to 6 foot long. So you're talking about from nose tip to tail tip, 7-8 foot.
That's a big turtle.
I tell you what, it's perfectly feasible in scientific terms, but that makes one heck of a monster. I don't know about you, but if I came across that in a swamp, that would be pretty terrifying.
No doubt. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Middletown, Connecticut.
Well, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, George and Richard, Jonathan.
Good morning.
I have a question about the Shubra Khambra.
Uh-huh.
Is it classified as any sort of species?
Not at the moment. I believe that we're talking about with the Chupacabra, we're talking about something which is outside the realms of conventional zoology. I'm convinced it exists because I've done autopsies on the victims of the Chupacabra. I've spoken to so many people who've seen it, and I've explored so many of the remote places where these things are supposed to live. I'm convinced that it has a level of objective reality, but I don't think that it is something that you can describe as an animal in the normal, conventional way. It is something far more paranormal, far less tangible, and something much weirder.
Oh, I have two quick comments.
No,
I'll try to make them real quick. This Shubra Khambra, like in the ecosystem of animals, and I'm like a huge animal lover, like does it serve any purpose or should they like be killed or something?
You sound like Roseanne Barr, by the way.
Huh?
You sound just like Roseanne Barr.
Oh, God. I also look kind of like her, which is a nightmare.
Well, I always thought Roseanne Barr is absolutely gorgeous.
Hmm?
I've always thought Roseanne Barr is absolutely gorgeous.
Well, with a six-figure plastic surgery, anybody can be.
Now, when you say does it serve a purpose, I believe that everything serves a purpose. Everything has its place to play in the incredibly complicated system of life and life and science on this planet. Everything has its part to play. And I think it's terribly dangerous when mankind tries to eradicate anything because you never know what the knock-on effects are going to be. Everything has its part to play, no matter how big, no matter how small, you know, in the pattern that is life.
And how do you protect yourself when you go out on expeditions?
Now, I'm not a very good churchgoer, but I'm a Roman Catholic of sorts. I haven't been a regular churchgoer for many years. But I tell you this, honey, after I'd been in this village in Mexico where the Chupacabra had caused such a level of fear. The first thing I did, I went to the shop in the local village. I bought myself a crucifix, and I had this rosary and a crucifix around my neck for the whole time I was there. And I always take it with me on expeditions now. It actually made me realize that, like Shakespeare said, there's more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy.
I'm a lapsed Catholic myself. Also, I want to ask you real quick.
Hey, how many questions you getting here?
Just two more comments.
She sounds like Roseanne Barr. She can ask as many questions as she wants.
All right, Jonathan. I may have found you your date.
There's one for you too, George. Have you ever seen or caught a Tasmanian devil?
No, I haven't. The Tasmanian devil is a known species of animal which, until very recently, was just thought only to live on the island of Tasmania. In fact, come to think of it, I have seen one in a zoo in Australia when I was a little boy. But in recent years, there's been suggestions that actually there's a relic population which might be actually a different species found on the mainland of Australia as well. But no, I've never caught one. But I have seen the Tasmanian devil in a zoo in Australia. But the Tasmanian wolf that Richard was talking about, the last known species, died in a zoo in Tasmania in 1936. But there have been so many sightings of them ever since that, to me, it's almost 100% certain that they're still existing.
Oh, okay. And then the other quick comments, one for George. I think your next vacation needs to be going on a dragon expedition.
Now that I might do.
Yeah, that would be great.
That would be
fun. Why don't you come along with us on one of our trips?
That I might do. I mean,
that would be like a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
I think Stuart Wilde wanted me to go on a trip to Brazil to drink some ayahuasca. I'm not going to do that.
I think I've always quite fancy doing that.
Okay, thanks. I'll call you Roseanne. I appreciate
it. No. I have one thing to say to Richard.
Well, hurry up. We got 300,000 phone calls coming in.
Yeah. I'm willing to be your girlfriend if you'll give up your big snake.
I'll pass it on one to Richard.
Just
go to our website. You can email us. And I think she met you, Jonathan.
She met you. I do believe if I didn't know you better, Jonathan, you were a little fond of her.
I think she's a honey pie. I'm looking forward to meeting her.
She did sound like Roseanne Barr.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Incredibly sexy.
Let's go to... You cryptozoologists are all alike. First time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the far northeast corridor of Texarkana.
Well, welcome to the show. You're a little scratchy on the phone, so go ahead. Get your question in.
I do not have a question. What I do have is a remark to the Bigfoot that he didn't know if it existed or not.
Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts?
What we got down here is also I live near the town of Fife, Arkansas, which is better known for the Boggy Creek Monster.
Right.
He is... You know, the way they explain it is something of the size of something like a Bigfoot, you know, 8-9 foot tall, hairy, very large, moves very fast. To hear some of the old-timers tell the story, I mean, they tell it with such passion. There's been pictures of, you know, just, you know, things that they have had. But also they tell stories of something like the government had moved in to try to, you know, slow some of the stuff that was coming out, you know, keep it out of the public eye.
Well, we've had lots of reports, Jonathan, from a lot of people in that general region and, of course, on the western coast of the United States up near Oregon of a lot of Bigfoot sightings.
Yeah, I actually believe in Bigfoot a lot more than Richard does, mainly because I've actually been there and Richard hasn't yet. And Richard will be coming to Texas soon with me this summer to and we'll be going around some of the Bigfoot places down there. I went with a colleague of mine, a guy called Chester Moore, in Orange County. I went out into the swamps and I saw the locations and I've seen his plaster cast of footprints and I've seen his photographs and I'm pretty convinced. I think it's very likely that there's something there.
How do you prepare?
What it is, I'm not sure, but there's something there.
How do you prepare for an expedition?
It depends on the expedition, really. It's that's a very difficult question. Sort of, how long is a piece of string? But it depends. What we do, we do our best to get as much background information as we can on the area we're going. The most important thing we do is we try to get somebody who's a member of our organization actually in the area, which is one of the reasons I like doing radio shows like yours, because we've got 400 members around the world now, and we're always looking for new people. So if people want to get in touch with me, we want to get as many new members as possible, because then when, like your last caller, if we went into his area looking for Bigfoot, we'd like to sort of liaise with people like him who actually live there already or are on the ground. So essentially, we've already got a support network set up for us when we go.
Our webmaster, Jonathan, has just emailed me a report from China that they have found, and he's dead now because apparently he died from lack of exercise. He was shot, almost a 2,000-pound pig, 8 feet long. Now, that's pretty big.
I saw that. Fantastic creature.
8 feet long.
That's even longer than me. I'm 6'7", and that's bigger than me.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Well, George, I'm glad there was so much laughter in that other caller. Roseanne, I don't remember what her real name
she,
was.
She sounded like that, didn't she?
When I got through, and then your screener, I guess, decided my question was interesting enough to be on the air, I suddenly became so nervous. I mean, really, I don't know what's more nerve-wracking, suddenly finding yourself on the air in front of millions of people or suddenly finding yourself tumbling off a cliff. But my question is, I saw a show, I think it was PBS, about the brush comb pines, I think, in Nevada. And they theorized that they were immortal, that they'd been around forever, and they just didn't die. They had so many rings dating back I don't know how long. I was wondering if your guests, or guests, actually, if you could ask both of them, if there could be any creatures on this planet that are immortal.
Immortal, that's a good question.
And of course, the trillion-dollar question, really, if there's any way a human can become immortal. And if you could ask both your guests, and I'll listen off the air.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. How about the immortality of a creature, Jonathan? What do you think?
Well, yeah, there are some creatures which are effectively immortal. When you look at some of the single-celled animals, like an amoeba, for example, amoebas don't breed. They just split in half. So essentially, any amoeba which you've got on this planet now is exactly the same as the first amoeba which first evolved hundreds of millions of years ago. It is an essentially the same creature. So amoebas are essentially immortal. But the more complex a creature gets, the more life systems there are to fail. And so to answer your listeners' other question, although very simple creatures are effectively immortal, and there are some complex plant colonies, mainly fungi, which are essentially immortal and can carry on forever. It's very unlikely that anything will ever be found that will make a human being immortal. The late Robert Heinlein, the science fiction author, theorized several ways in which human lifespan could be extended for semi-indefinite lengths of time, but unfortunately that's science fiction, not science fiction.
Yes, and not forever. Stay with us. Richard Freeman will join us next. We'll answer the rest of your phone calls, and then we'll wrap up at the end and say goodnight to both Jonathan and Richard. But Richard will take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
like an angel. Walk like an angel. Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are. Devil in disguise. You fooled me with your kisses. You cheated and you sinned. Heaven knows how you lied to me. You're not the way you seem. You look like an angel. Walk like an angel. Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh yes you are. Devil in disguise. I thought that I was in heaven, but I was sure surprised. Heaven help me, I didn't see the devil in your eyes.
To talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
I've got to ask Richard Freeman about, they're called Narie Ponds, N-A-R-E-E-P-O-N-S. Look it up on the website, do a search. They're from Thailand, and there's an incredible story about these things. They're supposed to be herbs, but when you look at a picture of it, it looks like a shriveled up elf or something like that. Unbelievable. I'm going to chat with Richard, see if he knows anything about that. In our next Coast to Coast program, couple guests. First of all, the first hour in our next Coast to Coast program, Richard C. Hoagland and Stephen Bassett will be on the show. We will be talking about an upcoming conference called Exopolitics on UFOs that will be held in the nation's capital in April, first hour. And then the rest of the program will be with Matt Savinar. Matt will be talking about the worldwide oil production, that it will peak in the near future, and we're not ready with any alternatives. As a matter of fact, there was a story today that broke out of Saudi Arabia that said that some of their oil fields were dwindling right down Matt Savinar's alley. So we'll chat with him, too. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. Make sure you're part of that show. After Dark newsletter, the March issue, of course, will be sent out soon. And we're getting down to the end. You talk about oil in Saudi Arabia maybe dwindling down. We're getting down to the end of the free CD of Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. It is yours now when you order the After Dark newsletter. 1-888-727-5505. And the other way, of course, is coasttocoastam.com. Well, now it's Richard Freeman's turn to take your phone calls. Richard, though, have you heard of this Narie Ponds from Thailand at all? In the story that goes with it?
I've not heard of that, no. There was a belief in something similar in medieval Europe called the mandrake, which was supposed to be a plant whose roots resembled a tiny, shriveled human being. And if you pulled it from the ground, it would scream. The scream was so terrible, you'd die.
When you have time after the show, just do a computer search for N-A-R-E-E-P-O-N, and it's a Thai flower pod. But I'm telling you, it looks exactly like a small, shriveled-up alien figure or an elf. It's incredible the way it looks. It really is. And I guess they have some kind of legend that goes with that. In your travels, have you had natives with legends, and they are so petrified of what creature might be in their region?
Oh, yes, yeah. with the Naga, people were terrified of it. Everyone who'd seen it said they were afraid of it. But bizarrely, a lot of them thought it was good luck to see the Naga. It was a semi-divine animal. Indochina in particular is a very weird place because it's Buddhist, but there's been a sort of cross-pollination from India, from the Hindus. So where they worship Buddha, you'll see statues of Kali and Hanuman and Ganesh and the other gods. And to the Buddhists, the Naga is a sort of a semi-divine creature because it saved Lord Buddha from drowning. But in Hindu mythology, it was supposed to be quite evil and terrifying. And the people were genuinely very afraid of what they'd seen, although none of them had actually been attacked. The old guy that took me down the caves, he said that he found a semi-precious stone down there after having seen the creature, and he had it mounted in a ring, and he thought that seeing the Naga, even though it was terrifying, brought him good luck. And he was quite a poor man, but after that he was left some money, and he became quite a successful farmer. Orang Pendek, the people have seen it. Once again, it's quite a shy creature that tries to keep away from people, but they're afraid of it because of its strength. Our guide, his father had seen one in the 80s, and he said it was lifting up logs and hurling them around like they were matchsticks, and he was very afraid of it.
All right, let's go.
When John went to hunt the chupacabra, he saw whole villages paralyzed by terror because of the attacks on livestock, and they painted huge crucifixes everywhere to ward the chupacabra away.
I could believe that, too. I could see them just totally terrorized by things that were going on, and I guess a lot of them didn't even know what to do. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Richard.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Amazing show. I feel like a kid again.
Me too.
Awesome. I had a quick question and quick comment.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, my question was, Richard, have you ever encountered any underground, like huge cavernous areas, such as what's supposed to be in Antarctica? And, you know, with water and just like almost an underground earth area?
Yes. When I was in Thailand, the caves I was in, they were supposed to go on for over 10 miles. And there were several underground rivers in them. And bizarre colonies of insects down there. But the caves were all quite small, very claustrophobic, except where the rivers ran through them. And then they opened out much wider, but they weren't absolutely huge places.
Amazing. And then I was going to mention just the idea, basically the chupacabra was described as kind of a kangaroo type figure, you know, with an insect praying mantis head and kind of with a gray alien. I'm wondering if maybe something genetically altered or engineered, you know, and, you know, maybe some extraterrestrial connection there, something like that, you know?
Possibly. I personally don't think aliens have ever been on Earth. I think the distances between stars are too great. I mean, if our sun was the size of an orange and it was in London, the nearest star to it, which is Alpha Centauri, I believe, that would be in Moscow. So we're talking about vast differences. Also, as well, I think creatures that evolved on another biosphere, a whole other planet, they wouldn't look so human. Most aliens, when people describe them, the greys and so on, look suspiciously human. I think they have more to do with fairy lore. I think the same phenomenon as the ancient legends of fairies and goblins and elves. I think they're an updating of that.
But you do not believe that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, then, right?
No. Okay. Not at all.
But East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
We are well.
I've got a question about a story I read in the news, I believe it was last year, about a small animal being found in Cuba, I believe.
Oh, yes.
That they believed was extinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the Cuban Selenodon. It's a insectivorous mammal about the size of a rabbit. It looks like a scaled-up shrew, and it's related to the shrews and the moles and the desmonds and the tenrecs and the hedgehogs. It's quite a small animal, thought to have been extinct for quite a long time, but it's turned up in the jungles of Cuba. There's quite a lot of weird stuff on Cuba. There may be the surviving colonies of the great ivory-billed woodpecker, which is also believed to be extinct.
Wow. See, I was curious because I heard they believed it was extinct, and then they found one, but they were hoping to find another one so that they could breed them and sort of, you know, have them in zoos and stuff.
Yeah,
I never heard.
I don't know if they've got a captive breeding population yet, but I think there's been several sightings of them out in the wild. It wouldn't surprise me because there's still a lot of jungle left in Cuba.
Well, I mean, if that's one species that's been refound, then there's hope for the Tasmanian wolf.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I know people who've seen the Tasmanian wolf. A guy I knew called Peter Chappell, who sadly died last year, he was an excellent zoologist and a great bushman, and he'd seen it on the mainland in Victoria on four different occasions. So I've no doubt that the Tasmanian wolf is still around.
Let's go to our wildcard line now. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
I tell you what, I am just I'm scared to death because this topic just fascinates me and yet it frightens me.
Why?
Well, you know, I love animals. I have a pond in my backyard full of turtles. I have a python, and I have an iguana, and I have dogs and cats and birds, and I work at the zoo part-time, you know, as a volunteer, and I'm an old nurse, and things like this just fascinate me. We're going to have to do this on a regular basis.
Yeah, but don't be afraid.
Well, I can't help it. I've been on hold for 45 minutes, and Tom gave me his cold.
But they're only unnamed creatures. But anyway, what's your question?
Jonathan and Richard. I apologize. I wanted to ask, and I don't know if this is Richard's topic or not. I think Jonathan was talking about this, but when he was talking about the chupacabra draining the animals of all the blood and taking the liver, I'm wondering, with the liver being the hepatic organ and the most blood-gorged organ besides the heart in the body, could that possibly have any connection? And I wanted to ask one other question, if I might, after he answers that.
Okay. Can you handle that one, Richard?
Sure. That's a very good point, and it's quite possibly why the liver is taken. One theory as well about animals moving and kicking around after they're dead when they've been attacked by the chupacabra is that there's something in the chupacabra's saliva that stimulates the nerves of the victim, so the heart keeps pumping, so it makes it easier for the creature to suck the blood of its victim. And if you remember the vampire legends, when the vampire bites its victim, they become undead themselves. So if they're still, the body is still twitching and moving out
mm-hmm.
after death, maybe this is where the legend comes from.
Good point.
Yeah, well, you know, they may also have something in their saliva, like a mosquito, that keeps the blood from coagulating.
Mm. Yeah, vampire bats have that as well.
And I also wanted to ask, I think another thing with Jonathan, I think I'm in love with Jonathan, I'm just going to admit it, you know, who cares? It's only us three talking, right?
Oh, God, Jonathan, everybody's getting,
jealous of Roseanne.
I should turn the show into a dating game, for crying out loud. Well, thanks for the call, appreciate it. Richard, on the travels that you two undertake, how many can you handle a year?
As many as it's not so much how many we can handle, it's how many we can afford. At the minute, we can afford one foreign one a year, and we get called in to do things in Britain. If we had the money or the sponsorship, I could handle as many as you could throw at me.
Okay, first-time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead. Where are you calling from, too?
My name is Leslie. I'm calling from Purvis, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
In regard, you were talking about the alligator snapping turtles.
Mm-hmm.
We have them everywhere here, and I grew up with a pond, and in our zoo in Jackson, we're about 2 hours south of Jackson, the capital, and they have giant ones there. I was thinking about, I would never do this, but if I lay down next to one...
No, don't do that.
I would not, but I'm only 5'3", and if I lay down next to one, my head would probably be the only thing coming up after. I mean, they're 3.5-4 feet right there that we see in the zoo.
Yeah, you'd end up being about 2'1". If you
I know, but I mean, they're here all over the place. We had them in our pond, not quite that big. My brother used to bring the babies at the house. My mother would have a fit, but... So we have them in Mississippi, but, and actually, I guess if you had an area that was large enough, you kept feeding them, they'd just get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, the thing about turtles is they have massive lifespans, and usually when they die, it's through misadventure. There was one of the Galapagos giant tortoises was taken to, I believe it was the island of Tonga, by Captain Cook on one of his voyages, and that only died in the 1960s because it was caught in a fire and inhaled smoke.
How old would that have made him?
Well, I think it was an adult when it was captured, so at least 300 years old.
Oh, my God. If they could only talk, Richard, you know what? The history, if they could only talk, the history they'd be able to tell us.
Yeah.
I guess there's something to be said about living a slow life, huh?
Yeah. Well, reptiles in general tend to live a very long time, and particularly tortoises and turtles.
300 years. I mean, that's amazing. It really is. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, this is David from Huntsville.
Hi, David.
I was just wondering if there was any, like, differences in growth cycles between the tropics. A lot of these places seem to lie between there, like Galapagos and Thailand and Christmas Island and Solomon Islands. Congo. I was just wondering if there was any difference.
See any differences out there, Richard?
Yeah, well, a lot of the places where you get things like tortoises and turtles getting very big, and like crabs on the Christmas Islands, it's because there are no large predators on these little islands. So animals can get very big. The dodo, I don't know if you know it or not, that was a giant flightless pigeon, and that lived on Mauritius, and it got so big that it couldn't fly purely because there was no predators to attack it. But when mankind got there, they wiped them out because they were now flightless, but we changed the evolutionary goalposts. In jungles, in places like the Congo and in South America, there's so much food around, and they're so undisturbed right in the center, you can get animals growing to fantastic sizes. For instance, there are stories of 50-foot-long crocodiles in the Congo. There are stories of giant snakes, giant lizards, all sorts of things. In the Amazon, there are stories of giant snakes. There are stories of surviving ground sloths, giant prehistoric sloths that live on the ground, the size of grizzly bears. Usually, when there's a lot of food and there's not a lot around to disturb you, you get things growing very, very big.
Let's go to our final caller, first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask your guest whether or not he thought there might still be Picarian megalodons existing, the grandfather of the great white.
Oh, yes. Megalodon, yes. Well, there's some controversy because now they think that it was not very closely related to the great white due to the shape of its snout and its jaws. It was actually more closely related to the tiger shark than the great white. Yes, this is a giant shark that grew to about 50 feet long.
50 feet?
Yeah. It lived in the Miocene. It was supposed to have died out about 3 million years ago. Now, unfortunately, the claims of surviving megalodons today are based on very shaky evidence. There was an author called Zane Grey who wrote a lot of westerns, and his son, they said they saw these giant sharks twice, but the descriptions they give are without a doubt descriptions of the contemporary and completely harmless whale shark. Also, there were some teeth of megalodon dredged up and examined, and they were thought to be about 11,000 years old, which is very, very recently for something we thought died out about 3 million years ago.
Well, that's
but
true.
Now we realize that the teeth had been actually reworked from an older sediment. They were much, much older. They were at least 10 million years old, but they'd been worked into a much younger sediment on the seabed. There is very, very little evidence to suggest that Carcharodon megalodon is still around today. It was a creature of shallow coastal waters. It fed on the slow-moving whales of the period. And if it was still alive, you'd be finding whales today washing up with big chunks bitten out of them. It would be attacking boats. It would be swallowing swimmers whole and so forth. Some people say, oh, these things could be surviving in the very deep trenches in the sea, you know, 5 miles or whatever beneath the sea. But that's nonsense. They were creatures that lived in warm, fairly shallow waters and fed on whales, and that there are not many whales in the very deep oceans, because obviously whales are air-breathing animals.
Exciting ventures, Richard. Exciting ventures indeed. Your website, of course, along with Jonathan Downs, cfz.org.uk, linked up right now with coasttocoastam.com. Richard, thank you, and yell over to Jonathan, by the way, and thank him for me as well, would you?
Yes, I will. Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, John.
Okay, Jonathan. And I'm sure Roseanne Barr is very delighted that you're on the program tonight. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Howard Morton in St. Louis, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, webmaster, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.